MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
It's that time of the week, a Tuesday afternoon, when we catch up with the Dr. Ross Walker. Hello, Ross, how are you?
I'm okay, mate. How are you going?
Not too bad. I was going to call you the Merry Medic. Have you ever been called the Merry Medic?
No. You can't do that, because that's James Wright's name.
Yeah,
you can't. Look, James was one of my mentors in radio.
Was he?
And I really took over from him at 2UE when he left.
Right.
And it was a dear friend of mine for many, many years, a beautiful guy, and I think he was the person who started the face of medicine for the public in this country. And he just had such a beautiful personality. He was such a giver. He lived in very, very humble circumstances. Money wasn't an issue to him at all. He just loved his job. Just a beautiful, beautiful human being.
Yeah, I've had a fortunate opportunity to speak to him a couple of times, and he's always, he's always just such a giving man.
Such a giving man. I've spoken to him on my radio show on many, many occasions, and I was on his show on many occasions, and I had the honour of being one of the people to give a speech at his 90th birthday party a few years ago.
Right. Okay. Let's ask you a couple of questions from people that have sent them in.
Sure.
Hi, Dr. Ross. My daughter is in her mid-20s. This is under the heading of Are Varicose Veins Genetic?
Yep.
Penny says, my daughter is in her mid-20s and is already developing pretty significant varicose veins in her left leg. She has always had a job where she's been on her feet, but also my mother has always had significant protruding veins. Is there anything she can do to stop this from happening, as it is having an impact on how she feels about herself?
Sure. Firstly, can I make the point, all conditions are genetic. So it's your genes that loads the gun, then your environment that pulls the trigger. So her daughter is on her feet all day. She's got the genes for varicose veins. You say, well, why aren't they on both sides? Just because that's how genes work. No one has the same arterial or venous system as anyone else, unless you're an identical twin. So there's always slight variations, and sometimes just because of posture and whatever, the left side will be worse than the right, or just because how the genes on one side are like that. If you look at your arms, so look at the veins in your arms where they put the drips in, some people have great veins on one side and not so good on the other side, and it just depends on how much you use that side of the body, etc., etc. Now, in terms of what you can do about varicose veins, there's no magic pill that's going to stop varicose veins. There's no magic natural supplement that's going to stop varicose veins. It's just seeing a person called a phlebologist. It's the word for a vein specialist. And what they do is they inject, and sometimes you might see a vascular surgeon who can do laser on the vein, or there's a thing called Clarivane where they put a catheter down and pull the vein out. But let me make the... Yeah, it's not pleasant, none of this. But the point is, whether it's injections or laser or the Clarivane or whatever they do, or stripping, it often recurs, because it's a weird thing with varicose veins. The treatment works for 5 to 6 months, maybe a year or so, but then it often comes back. But there's things that can be done on a regular basis, but there's no cure for varicose veins apart from the surgery, which tends to fix up, but even then it can recur.
So varicose veins, it doesn't matter how old you are, how fit you are, all those sort of things, it can just still happen to you.
Just still happen to you, and some people get it very early. Other people might get it in their 50s, 60s and 70s. And again, the veins, people get this confused. The veins are the blood vessels that take blood back to the body under low pressure. And when you think about it, when you stand up all day, the blood's got to be pumped from your legs right up into the heart against gravity.
Right.
And so you've got these little valves going up through the veins, and as time goes on, the valves get a bit weak, so you get more congestion in your legs, which is why, at the end of the day, it happens to me, you take your socks off and there's a bit of an indentation from the socks, because a little bit of fluid seeped out into the legs. It's normal.
Does it affect men and women the same?
Women tend to get more varicose veins than men, but men can have very bad varicose veins, even to the point where for men and women, a thing called varicose eczema, where you get this dreadful eczematous rash over where the veins are, and it can break down into what's the worst case scenario, a varicose ulcer, which is very difficult to treat. Sometimes things like hyperbaric oxygen are necessary, but you don't want to get it to that point. Go and see a phlebologist. That's P-H-L-E-B, phlebologist.
Okay. This is from Andrew. He says, I'm in my late 60s and I'm finding it really hard to get a good night's sleep. It is restless and it seems like I need to go to the bathroom every hour. This is only a recent development, like in the past 2 months. Is there anything I can do to get a better night's sleep?
Well, firstly, the fact that he's getting up every 2 hours to pass urine is not normal. And interestingly, the first symptom of something going wrong with your kidneys, especially if it hasn't happened before, so just happens in your 60s out of the blue, it may be an indication of something going wrong with the kidneys. So it's not a bladder issue, it's a kidney issue, and the kidneys aren't concentrating urine properly overnight. So you're producing more urine when you're asleep, which is unusual because you shouldn't. So I think before Andrew does anything, what he needs to do is go and have a full evaluation of his kidney function, get what's called an MSU, which is a midstream urine looking for infection, looking for red cells, white cells, what we call casts and protein, and also have a blood test to make sure his kidney function is normal. That would be the first thing to do. If all that checks out normal, then you've got to look at what may be going on in his prostate. The prostate and bladder can cause these symptoms as well, and that's another issue if that's the case. But first thing, always get the kidneys checked.
I've got more questions, but we'll leave it there. Otherwise, we may not get to talk about all the things that you have sent me. So let's start.
Whatever suits.
On that, mate. Women aged 50. Women may age fastest during their 30s and their 50s.
Yeah.
A woman may be most likely to give birth in her 30s, it says, and go through menopause in her 50s. Tell me more about this.
Yeah, now this was a study out of Korea where they took 113 women aged between 20 and 66 and did a comprehensive analysis of many metabolic features, facial features, physical characteristics, things like height, weight, blood pressure, lung capacity, grip strength, ability to stand, telomere length, facial dimensions, gut microbiome, hormones, lipids. They did all these different things. And they found that these were all good markers of how rapidly you aged. And they were really talking about the effects of pregnancy and the effects of menopause in accelerating the aging process. Because during those times, a woman's body is either flooded with hormones or they start to lose their hormones. And they found that this loss or change in hormones was a big feature in accelerating aging. But they made some other important points here. Other things that accelerate aging, other than those times when you have a child or when you go through menopause, are obviously life stressors. And if you see people who've had very, very stressful lives, they do look a lot older than other people their age, or people who are still foolish enough to smoke, because smoking really accelerates your biologic age. And interestingly, people who had buckets of fruits and vegetables throughout their life and a lot of whole grains were biologically younger, and also women who, and here's a controversial thing, women who started hormone replacement therapy around the time of menopause, it slowed down their biologic age. And a lot of women would be listening and saying, hang on a minute, doc, 20 years ago they told us hormone replacement therapy was bad, no one should do it. Well, let me tell you where that came from. There was a study called the Women's Health Initiative, which studied thousands of women over a number of years and gave a placebo-controlled trial where they gave half of them hormone replacement therapy and the other half nothing, a placebo. Now, why that was a stupid trial is because often women were started on hormones over the age of 65. So they'd gone for 15 years without much in the way of hormones, then they flogged their body with hormones. It didn't make any sense at all, and those were the women who ran into trouble. But if you're having significant issues with menopause and you start hormone replacement therapy, and I'm a fan of bioidentical hormones, or a lot of conservative doctors aren't, they prefer you to use the pharmaceutical stuff. But if you start the hormone replacement therapy around the time of menopause, that has, I think, a beneficial effect for some people. But the problem with menopause is a difficult subject. It's a third, a third, a third. So a third of women do very well with HRT, a third it doesn't hurt, doesn't help, and another third it can cause all sorts of issues for those people. And the skill of a clever doctor is finding out which women fits which category.
Is it true that women that have had breast cancer can't have hormone replacement therapy?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You certainly would avoid that because a lot of these breast cancers are very sensitive to the effects of estrogen, and so you can't give them HRT in that situation. So you've got to really speak to your specialist about that, but I wouldn't be rushing off and taking things that were full of estrogen if you already had breast cancer.
One of the points in this article that I was reading, for me, being a bloke, it was an interesting fact. Women show signs of cellular aging at 19 that men show at age 40.
It's interesting, and this is, and you often see this as well when couples have been together for a long time. Not always, but often the woman ages quicker than the man, and that's probably because the women have to put up with men.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, but it's just different hormones. It's all the different hormonal effects. And if you think about in our situation, men really just have pretty similar levels of testosterone through their earlier years, and when you get into your 50s, the testosterone levels start to drop off. As I say, for all us men over 50, everything stiffens up apart from the bit you want to. And whereas in women, they have these cyclic ranges of hormones. So, and they'll tell you all this when they'll get a big burst of estrogen in the first half of the cycle, and they get estrogen, progesterone in the second half of the cycle, and they've got to go through menstruation. I mean, it's hard work, and it's a lot of hormonal changes that happen even throughout 1 month for a woman.
Screening ages need to be lowered for colon cancer.
Yeah, this is a disturbing fact, that over the past 20 years or so, the rates of colorectal cancer in younger people, people below the age of 50, have basically doubled. There was a study done in New Zealand showing that that people below the age of 50, 14% increased risk for colorectal cancer in men and 13% increase in women below the age of 50 from 1995 to 2012 in the US, double. It's concerningly, in the Maori population, I think you could probably extrapolate these figures to our Aboriginal population, colorectal cancer increased by 30% in women and 25% in men before age 50. Now, the question is, why is colorectal cancer increasing? And I think the major reason is changes in diet, increase in weight, some environmental factors, and obviously what you and I talk about all the time, the change in the gut microbiome. So two countries, Italy and Austria, have had screening for colorectal cancer from age 40 since the 1980s, and they have much lower rates of colorectal cancer because the point is that they pick up polyps long before we pick them up. And if you get rid of the polyps, the person doesn't have cancer, but you stop them from having cancer, because all colorectal cancer is due to polyps changing into a cancer.
Right. So what you're saying is, people listening to us this afternoon, if you're, what, over 40,
yeah,
you should possibly go and have a test.
Yeah, well, we could at least start with the National Bowel Cancer Screening Program, which is free for people from 50 to 74. But we're talking about now, and I'm the chairman of the Gut Foundation, even though I'm a cardiologist. I was the president. I said, really, it should be a gastroenterologist being the president. But I've been on the board of the Gut Foundation for the last 5 or 6 years. And we're sort of pushing to try and reduce the screening age for people so we can get more people thinking about bowel cancer.
Okay. A vaccine has been developed that could go a long way to possibly treating Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, and I interviewed on my show last Sunday night a person who's in Queensland developing a vaccine for the herpes virus as well. So we should probably come back to that. But on this particular vaccine, it's only been trialled in mice, and mice who were genetically predisposed to getting Alzheimer's disease. You and I have spoken before about these senescent cells. So mm-hmm. The senescent cells are, as we get older, we get more senescent or aging cells in our body. And it's a bit like, and this doesn't happen in all cases, but having a hike where there's a bunch of 20-year-olds up to a bunch of 80-year-olds, typically, but not always, the 80-year-olds slow down the 20-year-olds. And it's the same thing with these senescent cells. These senescent cells, what they basically do is steal nutrients from the healthy young cells and also secrete these pro-inflammatory proteins into the bloodstream. So what these researchers have done is taken this protein called senescence-associated glycoprotein, we'll just call it SAGP for brevity, and they've developed a vaccine against this SAGP, and they found when they gave it to mice who were genetically predisposed to getting Alzheimer's disease, they had much less of these amyloid beta proteins that are associated with it, much less inflammation, and showed signs of much better memory. So what they do with mice to see if they've got signs of dementia is they put them in a maze and see how quickly they can get out of the maze. So interesting stuff. It's a long way to go, not available yet, but they should start human testing probably at some stage over the next 3 or 4 years.
In 10 years, can you see through your crystal ball, can you see that we'll have a test to see if we're going to be affected by Alzheimer's disease, and if those results come back that we are going to be affected in years to come, we will have a course of injections that will fix us?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think that, in fact, let's not just talk about Alzheimer's disease. They're talking about vaccines for heart disease, vaccines for cancer, vaccines for Alzheimer's. And I think all of these things will be standard of care probably 15 to 20 years away. And people like me, especially the interventional cardiologists, will probably be looking for something else to do. Right. Because if you can vaccinate people against heart disease, you wipe out an industry. So it's a bit like the pharmacist saying we shouldn't have these 60-day prescriptions. I mean, I shouldn't bring this up really on a medical segment, but they're saying they shouldn't because they're not going to be able to maintain pharmacies in isolated areas because of the marked reduction in wages by cutting the time of just prescribing a script from 30 days to 60 days. So it's the same thing. There are going to be cardiologists looking for different work. And you think about it, 20 years ago, we got our entertainment from Video Easy or Blockbuster. They've gone now because they've been replaced by streaming services. In the same way, vaccines might get rid of all the major diseases that are keeping many doctors in a job.
Yeah, and what does that say for, you know, how long we live, as long as we can live healthy? It's, you know, there are so many more people these days reaching the age of 100 in 20 years' time. It might be the average age of 120 in longevity.
Exactly, yeah. And so that's why we have to rethink the whole retirement thing. Think of what's just recently happened in Paris when Macron tried to put the retirement age up to 67, or 65, I think, 65 to 67, and the place went nuts, saying, how dare you? I think in Greece, the retirement age is 45. And if you're going to live to your 100, 120 and live well, why give up work? I just don't get it.
Yeah, true. Kombucha. A lot of people like to have a drink of kombucha. Apparently it reduces sugar levels in type 2 diabetics.
Yeah, well, you see, the interesting thing is that I think human beings have really grown accustomed to having that fizzy feeling when you drink soft drinks, whether it's artificially sweetened drinks or sugar-sweetened drinks. But we know that those things are bad for us. So if you have one sugar-sweetened drink a day, you increase your risk for diabetes 50%. One artificially sweetened drink a day, you increase your risk for type 2 diabetes about 20%. But this study is only a small study of 12 people who were type 2 diabetics, but it was a crossover study. So for the first 4 weeks, half of them were given the kombucha drink, the other half were given a similar tasting beverage that didn't have the active ingredients of kombucha. And for the second half of the study, same thing, 4 weeks of drinking the kombucha, and the other ones went back to the placebo. And they've got the kombucha has a different types of probiotics and a yeast. And they found in those who had a daily kombucha drink had a reduction in blood sugar level. And this is quite dramatic, mate. Normal blood sugar is probably below 5. Well, is below 5. These diabetics had an average blood sugar of 9.1, dropped down to 6.4 with the kombucha.
And does it stay there if you drink it each day, if you have a drink of kombucha each day?
Yeah, it keeps your sugar. It's one of the treatments to keep your sugar level. Now, that doesn't mean you can drink a kombucha drink a day and eat what you like. No one's talking about that, but this is just a controlled trial that went on for 8 weeks. And these people obviously being monitored and their diet was being monitored as well. and showed a dramatic reduction in sugar. I think it's quite extraordinary.
So I have a bottle of water here in front of me, a 600ml bottle of water that I consume yep. through my show of an afternoon. Does this mean
hopefully
I should possibly...
Tell me it's not in plastic, please.
It is, actually.
Does this mean
that I should replace this with a bottle of kombucha each afternoon?
Or at least have one kombucha every day or so. I think it's not a bad thing to do. Not but this study was only done in diabetics. It's not going to make normal people's sugar go any lower, nor should it. We don't need it to. Mm-hmm. But what we wanted is, what people don't realise is that the real pandemic of the 21st century is not coronavirus, it is diabetes. And we're really getting to the point where this is becoming a public health dilemma, and especially in Indigenous people, it's even worse. So we really have to get better solutions for managing diabetes.
I suppose we shouldn't talk about the cocktail that I saw whereby you put gin with a kombucha.
No, I don't think we should get it.
No? Okay. Nah. Just quickly, studies show both men and women who are vegetarian face increased risk of hip fracture.
Yeah. And in the same week, a study came out saying that men and women who are vegetarians have lower rates of cardiovascular disease. So I don't think we should put this into too much concern for people. But it was a study of just over 413,000 people, men and women, from the UK Biobank that went on for an average follow-up for about, I think it was about 5 years. And they found that the vegetarians had a 50% increased risk for hip fracture. But let's look at the statistics. And here where you've got to be a bit careful about statistics. The basic incidence was in the people who were vegetarian compared with the people who weren't vegetarian, there were 3 more hip fractures per 1,000 people, over 10 years. So we're not talking about a huge amount of increase, but the statistics said that's a 50% increase. In the same way, if you have a piece of bacon every day, so processed meats every day, you increase your risk for bowel cancer by 17%. Now, in real terms, the risk for bowel cancer is six bowel cancer episodes per 100 people per lifetime. If you have bacon every day, you make that 7 bowel cancer events per 100 people.
It's neither here nor there. I've got to go to the news, Ross. I'm sorry, mate. You know what it's like. Talk to you next week. Thanks, mate. Dr. Ross Walker.